Radio Drone. Welcome to another lovely episode of Radio Drome. Brad and Brian are off being Brad and Brian again. I think they're like going to a con or something. They're going to some nerd convention. So this week I have on our semi-regular guest, Mike White of the Projection Booth.
Hello.
And then we also have, dredging the depths of the internet, Charlie McMullen from Geek Juice.
And what depths they are.
So you guys have both been on before, but never together. So this is a first time for the two of you. So be gentle with each other.
So we can finally put to bed those rumors that we're actually the same person.
I know. I'm sick of getting your mail.
Are those rumors or conspiracy theories? I'm not sure what the difference is.
Depends entirely on the context.
Well, speaking of conspiracy theories, what actually got me to think about this, the topic tonight, I found a bunch of old UFO conspiracy nut magazines from the 1970s. So I wanted to talk to you guys about magazines. What happened, specifically entertainment magazines? Let me ask you first, Mike, since you ran a magazine and I know you're deeply rooted in this community. Do you think the magazine, and I'm talking print magazine, is dying, is dead, or you think it's just sort of at a lower level? Where do you see it right now?
Yeah, definitely there have been a lot of deaths, but there are still some that are out there hanging on, and I think they will for quite a while. I don't think that there's going to be the breadth of zines that there were ever again. I think that time has passed, and as far as magazines, I think that time has pretty much passed, and I think that the ones that are remaining will probably carry on for a little while longer, but I think that they might eventually phase out. Kind of sad to say, but I think that I think that magazine racks are probably going to continue to get smaller, but I think the big kill off of magazines has already occurred.
So it's sort of like we had the culling, and now we've got the stronger pieces that rose to the top.
I don't know about stronger. I wouldn't necessarily consider the ones that are left to be stronger. I think they have watered themselves down, or at least a lot of them have. I mean, there are definitely some that are holding true to their ideals. I think there's definitely quite a few camps out there. I'm thinking of stuff like, you know, Empire, and then there's Paracinema. So, you know, and then there are the ones like, you know, Famous Monsters of Filmland. So you're looking at quite a few different breeds of magazines that are out there right now.
I see a death in progress, at least in terms of actual tangible print magazines, which is really just not the same thing as reading anything on the internet. It just doesn't have the same feel. I'm a bit of a sensory purist. Did I just make that up? I did. You're welcome, internet. But I definitely see a death in progress. I think the internet is largely to blame for the end of magazines as we know it.
I gotta disagree with you on that. I don't think the internet is to blame for the death of magazines. I think the magazines and the publishers are to blame for their own death, for refusing to see what the internet is doing and counter it.
Because that's also a very good point.
Because one of my problems is you've got a magazine such as Fangoria, just as an example. They have not changed their business model. With the internet giving us information right away, as soon as a new star is revealed or the new trailer comes out for a new movie, boom, it's all over the blogs. It's going to be a month to a month and a half before it's in that magazine. Why do they still carry movie news in these magazines and waste pages on it? By the time you read it, it's already 2 months old. That arch refusal to change how the magazine is formatted.
I still get a lot of my news from things like Entertainment Weekly. I don't know if I just don't tune into the right blogs and Twitter feeds and all that kind of stuff. I guess because there's such an echo chamber as far as, you know, you read something on one site, you read it on 100. So in order to tune that out, I just try not to read a whole lot of movie sites. So because I have yet to find one that is the proper level of snarkiness that I can handle. I have yet to find one where it's like, you know, I'll go to like quietearth.us or something like that. And generally, because it's a nice subset of movie news and they don't try to do everything to and try to be all things to all people. So like, you know, there are others where I just try to stay away from them. So I still actually really look forward to getting the new Entertainment Weekly every Friday or Saturday and seeing what kind of deals have been made and just enjoying my news that way.
I get most of my news from TV because my internet usage is usually limited to listening to our podcasts and porn. And as you know, that's a pretty full day. So I don't usually go to a lot of movie sites just in general. If I like if somebody links me an article and says you got to check this out, then I'll go. But I used to go to movie sites a lot, like Rotten Tomatoes, which I think would have made a great magazine. And I would get into these comment wars with reviewers, which, while fun, took up like a pathetic amount of my time. So I don't think movie websites are an adequate substitute for movie magazines.
I think no, not for a magazine in general. I mean for the news aspect. I mean for all of a sudden when Fangoria breaking news, you know, first pics of the new Texas Chainsaw Massacre 3D that have been online for 4 weeks already, just kind of doesn't have the same effect it did in 1988, does it?
No, it definitely doesn't have the same effect. And I mean, there's an obvious advantage just in terms of getting content available for public viewing fastest. You don't have to start printing presses and buy ink to post something online. I don't know. It just seems less rewarding to read it online because plus you can't really put too much faith in the credibility of everything you see online. I have to see something two or three times to make sure it's not a hoax because I spent a lot of time this past weekend thinking Morgan Freeman was dead. And I'm just not ready to be hurt like that again.
But then you also have, and this is something I saw, especially when the new Dark Shadows movie came out. All the magazines, like all the other magazines, I'm specifically looking at the horror and movie magazines. Horror Hound, Rue Morgue, Diabolique, Fangoria, Empire, and SFX all had a picture of Johnny Depp from the new Dark Shadows movie on the cover the same month. They all looked exactly the same. It was almost the same photo. How are you supposed to compete when you look like everyone else? I would have liked to have seen the magazine that month that said, we're not going to put Dark Shadows on the cover. We're going to put out some other movie that happens to be coming out that same month. We're going to make the cover that because we know all our competitors are going to put Johnny Depp on the cover. Or am I just ignorant in the way the magazine business operates to think that's the way I would do it?
Can see that you want to put the most popular thing on the cover in order to sell stuff and maybe to get the audience that normally wouldn't go for it. I mean, personally, I would go for the movie that I felt strongest about as far as, you know, story and being a compelling watch. Just seeing the preview for Dark Shadows made me not want to see it, and I would try to stay definitely clear of that, and I would be kind of ashamed to put that on the cover of my magazine if I were some sort of self-respecting horror magazine. But you know, you're looking to sell product, and that's really where it all boils down to.
I don't think you're being ignorant. I think you're being idealistic. I think that's something. I think that's something that we all do from time to time. I mean, there's the sites that set themselves apart from every other possible site that the average person can go to. They need to figure out a better way to set themselves apart. Magazines had a better way to do that. Magazines had reputations. You know, like if you read Fangoria, they're going to have bloodier pictures than Entertainment Weekly because Entertainment Weekly, their advertisers are more corporate, more, bottom line oriented than Fangoria's.
I think mass audience oriented.
Yeah, exactly. And I think there's no way for websites to differentiate themselves from each other like that.
I appreciate the magazines that kind of live in their own worlds and can be supported by their own subscribers, by their own means, you know, something like a Film Comment or a Cineast or CinemaScope from Canada or Wide Angle. Some of these where it's much more niche in their subject matter. I mean, of course, they're all dealing with film, but they all deal with them on their own levels and really aren't beholden necessarily to more of a, you know, a corporate sponsor. I mean, or at least a kind of a more mass audience corporate sponsor, I guess. You know, you're looking at definitely having advertisers in there, but it's not necessarily the same game that an Entertainment Weekly or even a Fangoria are playing. And that way they can get deeper into their news and do their things, but also they're probably selling, you know, just a minuscule fraction that these other magazines are selling, but that's fine. I'm glad they're still there, and I'm glad I'm able to read them, and they're the magazines that really, to me, are, you know, pushing the boundary of film criticism and looking at things in a much different way than this kind of real glossy, you know, give me 100 words about this and give me 200 words about that, and, you know, these kind of more, you know, I just want to look at pretty pictures of, you know, what Sherry Moon Zombie is going to look like in the next Rob Zombie film.
Along that same lines of what you just brought up, there is also the willingness to bite the hand that feeds you, which is something you don't see very often nowadays. Now, I'm going to butcher this magazine's name. Mike, Charlie, I need you guys to help me. Is it Cinema Fastique? Is that how that magazine used to be pronounced?
I thought it was like Cinema Festivique.
It's so funny because I was just talking to Paul Salmon the other day, and he used to write for this, and he was very particular in the way that he pronounced it. It was I don't remember the first part. I believe it's just Cinema, but the last part for sure it was very fantastique.
Okay, well that magazine used to, I loved that magazine. That was a non-advertiser supported magazine. It had a higher cover price, but you got all content. Instead of Fangoria, where every third page would be, you know, a VHS ad or something like that, it was all content on every page, and you got what you paid for. The fact that they were not beholden to any advertiser meant they were the true source of film journalism in the 80s, and that killed them. A lot of times when you found out about these behind-the-scenes shenanigans, such as Harlan Ellison's lawsuit against James Cameron, things like that, and you found out about actors walking off sets and disastrous shoots and things like that, they were the ones that broke that. And then they stopped getting invitations to preview screenings, and they were barred from visiting sets. And because the studio said, these guys are going to tell the truth about us, I don't want them writing about us. So in a way, being true and not beholden to the advertisers cuts you off from the information that your competitors have until they change that later on in their run. But is it a good thing or a bad thing that they held to their morals as long as they did and said, we're going to write true about these movies, whether the studios like it or not?
I think it's a bad thing for a number of different reasons. Entertainment Weekly, while occasionally will have a really good story, is for the most part the worst offender, pandering to their sponsors, really. I mean, it got to a certain point where they don't even care about their readership anymore. They only care about making their sponsors happy. That is a bad thing. But also, especially within the Hollywood system, this obsessive, and I will say it, childish need for secrecy is ruining the reporting. Like the reporters are all hamstrung, like in terms of what can be published and what can't be published. That leaves the readership to get nothing but puff pieces. They have to go to the internet for any actual information.
When it comes to the internet and when it comes to too much quote-unquote journalism, I mean, there are too many times where somebody sees something printed and doesn't do the, you know, the actual fact-checking or anything, and you just see the same misinformation being printed over and over and over again, and it just gets to the point where it's so sickening. And when you actually go out and do the legwork and find out what it is, we find out what the real story is. I mean, that really become a footnote at some point, but the lie that has been told so many times becomes the truth. You know, it's the whole Citizen Kane kind of thing, right? But I'm sorry, I'm going really completely
you
off went, point I'm with that.
Film student with us right there with Citizen Kane.
I actually got flashbacks. That was nice.
I will say that it was nice that Cinema Fantastique would do their own thing and not be beholden to the advertisers, because there are some magazines out there where you can't necessarily tell what an ad is and what the article is next to it. And I'm not talking about poor layout. I mean, one reason I quit reading Giant Robot was because I couldn't tell with the layout anymore what was an ad and what was an article. But there are too many times where, you know, you see a ad for something and you know 2 pages later or 20 pages later, there's going to be a glowing review of whatever this movie is that you just saw advertised. And that, to me, kind of turns my stomach.
Well, how about, and Fangoria was guilty of this for the longest time. I haven't read the magazine in a couple of years, so I don't know if the new editorship has changed this or not. They would give all these, you know, glowing 8-page spreads to the new slasher movie, to the new Eli Roth movie, talking about how great it's going to be and blah, blah. And then they would go and trash it in the reviews in the back of the magazine. Is that good that you've got the two different points of view, or is that sort of, we want the exclusive photos, but we can't give this piece of shit a glowing review? We just can't.
I used to get really upset with magazines. Like, some of the incarnations of Film Threat would really kind of turn me off, as far as having the different reviewers be so radically different. And it was like, can we please just take a stand? Can we say, like, you know, this movie is good or bad or somewhere in between, rather than having this kind of, you know, on page one, it's the best movie in the world, and on page 13, it's the worst movie in the world. If that's the case, let's take these two reviewers and give them a good point counterpoint kind of review type of thing, where, and I enjoy that kind of debate, but having, you know, two different points of view so many pages apart just was a little like schizophrenic almost. And it was like, can we please just have some sort of narrative or editorial voice here that's going to assure that, you know, we're reading kind of the same theme throughout the entire magazine? Or, you know, there's always the you know, I think Film Threat was also guilty of this, as far as, we're going to give this thing a cover story in one issue, and then 2 issues later, this was the worst piece of crap in the world. So they had at least a couple issues in between there, rather than, you know, the Eli Roth expose on page 20 and then page 80 having the blurb review talking about how awful it is.
Well, I was going to ask Mike this in preparation for tonight's show. Mike, what would you say Film Threat's heyday was?
Gosh, for me, it was probably when they first moved out to LA. I thought that they were really kind of doing that great snotty kid kind of thing, and were really kind of biting the hand that feeds them. I enjoyed that they didn't hold anything sacred.
Would that be the end of the Chris Gore era or the beginning of the Larry Flint era? Because I personally loved maybe the last 5 or 6 issues of when Chris Gore was running it himself, but before they moved to Larry Flint Publications.
I definitely enjoyed Gore's voice being a much bigger part of the magazine. I would say probably somewhere in that transition is where I found it to be kind of a golden age.
I would more or less agree with that. I think because I was a subscriber to Film Threat for a number of years, probably the only one in the town that I grew up in that had ever heard of Film Threat. But I remember in the early to mid 90s, like 92 to 94, it got really good because everybody was taking shots at Rob Weiss, and deservedly so, because that guy was a complete tool. But I used to just really like reading reporting like that, like not afraid to offend anybody. And now it's like what Josh was saying, they'll kiss Eli Roth's ass on and at the head of the magazine and then trash his movie. I mean, that does something to affect the credibility of the magazine in total for me.
But see, Film Threat did one thing that I thought was brilliant, and I think something like Entertainment Weekly would probably gain readership if they did, and I don't think it would cost them readership. Yes, you can have Twilight on the cover, you can have the Avengers on the cover, but like what Film Threat did is they would have Batman on the cover, they'd have Natural Born Killers on the cover, Quentin Tarantino on the cover, and then they'd be talking about Cannibal Holocaust in the last third of the magazine. So you'd get the hardcore exploitation fans, and you'd get the mainstream audience both buying the same magazine.
Sort of a bait and switch.
Yeah, and I thought that was brilliant on Chris Gore's level to put them, you know, put Macaulay Culkin on the cover and then talk about the Italian cannibal music, therefore exposing it to people who would never have bought an issue of the old Film Threat. And I think Entertainment Weekly would be good to do that, to have more obscure reviews in the back. Maybe devote 10 pages of the magazine to that, and then you can have all the Joss Whedon love in the front of the magazine. You'd get both worlds. But someone like Entertainment Weekly, their editor says, no, we're mainstream, and that's all we are. I think that is going to be – that mindset is what's going to kill these magazines, not willing to – kind of tease both audiences.
I do think that Entertainment Weekly has definitely gone way downhill over the last 2 years, maybe a little bit more. There used to be kind of more of that attitude and more of that idea that was going on. I mean, if it wasn't necessarily a conscious thing, at least I was getting a little bit more out of the magazine than I do now. There used to be, you know, reviews or, you know, kind of retrospectives of different people, you know, different actors or different, you know, oh, here, let's look at, you know, this subgenre and kind of, you know, take this apart, you know, just something interesting. And now it's like I can read the magazine pretty darn quickly. I mean, I will go through the deal report, which is what I was talking about before, as far as getting my news from that, and, you know, the deaths and the marriages and all those kind of things, just kind of keeping up. Though whenever I say, oh, this is interesting, so-and-so got married, or so-and-so died, or so-and-so is getting sued, my wife, who reads Yahoo News, is always like, oh yeah, I knew about that a couple days ago. It's like, oh, all right.
Exactly. So, what I was talking about.
Exactly. But it's not anything critical for me. So it's like, oh, hey, you know, the celebrity had a kid and is marred it for life with a horrible name, you know, so I just get all of those all at once.
Debate and Switch is good, but I would like for it to be more than that. I would like for Entertainment Weekly to have not even a whole, like, they don't have to change their whole format, but just like add a section with some off the radar stuff. I mean, it would definitely increase readership. It would be thought provoking, which is probably why they won't do it. But I don't think that's going to happen, because there's just no way around, you know, getting that approved by sponsors that just don't want to hear any of that.
Okay, well, what about grabbing someone with a cover right away? Especially in the internet age, you need a good looking cover. Going back to Cinema Fastique. They used to always, well, not always, probably 90% of the time from their inception through about 1997, 1998, they had an original painting for the cover. Every now and then they'd have a photo cover of like George Romero or something if it was a special issue, but most of the time it was a painting. Then for whatever reason, they decided, let's just put a picture of Jennifer Garner or Fox Mulder on the cover. And it, to me, started looking like every other magazine. Horror Hound still does this. They have a painting on almost every cover. Then you've got the ones like SFX and Empire and Fangoria that just take some stock photograph of some big movie. I mean, it was funny. When Cowboys vs. Aliens came out, Total Film, Empire, and SFX all had the exact same photo tinted a different color for Cowboys versus Aliens on the cover. It was literally the exact photo they got from the studio. And it's like all these magazines look exactly the same other than the title. That to me does not make me want to buy one over the other.
I did notice that when Cowboys and Aliens was out, it reminded me of the time in like 94, 95 when Newsweek completely just threw away their entire reputation by making OJ blacker.
I remember that one, yes.
I think the cover comes down to the bottom line. A magazine is going to go with whatever cover is going to get most people to pick it up off the newsstand. I think in a perfect world, an original painting, like a really eye-catching one, like maybe like a Tom Savini sketch, if you want. In a perfect world, that would get the most people, but it's going to be a big celebrity photo that's going to get most people to pick it up off the newsstand.
You know that the cover of Cashiers to Cinema was, I think we had one photo. I mean, the very first couple issues were photos, and then started to get original paintings from Nathan Kane. And then since then, we've had other artists that have come in and done their thing. And I will say that, you know, I've gotten a lot of crap over the years of, you know, why are you doing this? Why do you have the pinup girls on the cover? And it's like, well, because I dig it. I think this is a great look. But is it going to sell magazines? Maybe, maybe not. Does it misrepresent what's inside? Maybe, maybe not. But I liked it. I thought that they looked cool. So, and that's really, I mean, that's the advantage that I have being a zine, is that I could do whatever the heck I wanted to, no matter what kind of sense it made.
True. But then you've also got like when Fangoria, they've always had that from like the second or third issue, that iconic logo with the Fangoria logo and then the film strip down the side with the three mini photos and then the big feature photo. And then for whatever reason, shortly after issue 200, I mean, they brought it back. But for a couple of years, they ran without that, just looking like every other magazine. I thought that was just a shockingly stupid editorial decision. Some idiot in the Fangoria office said, yeah, this has been working for 20 plus years. Just get rid of that. I want to look like an Entertainment Weekly cover with a werewolf on the cover. I just didn't understand the getting rid of the iconic cover scheme, which then Horror Hound picked up. Horror Hound picked up that, and now Horror Hound every month looks like a Tales from the Crypt cover. And it's eye-catching, and your eyes go right to it, and they make you want to pick it up.
I do enjoy the Horror Hound covers.
That's what I used to love about Fangoria, because I was a subscriber to Fangoria for a while, too, and I used to love the covers because they reminded me of comic books.
Well, and then you also have the thing when it comes to these magazines is price. I mean, Fangoria is $9.99 an issue. At least a third of the magazine is ads. And I do not understand how that magazine survives with that kind of price. Whereas Horror Hound has more pages, less ads, and is only $6.99 an issue. I can't understand in the Fangoria offices how they can't go, why is Horror Hound outselling us?
Well, you would be amazed at the price difference in ads, too. I mean, I tried to take out some ads for my book a few years ago, and I pretty much had to laugh off quite a few of the magazines when I finally got their ad sheets and just said, yeah, no, that's not going to happen.
But, I mean, do you agree that the prices are a little outrageous? I mean, especially if you get Empire or Total Film or SFX, one of the import magazines that you get from England, some of those are $13 American a piece, and that's a little expensive for a magazine.
Yeah, I mean, what, Shock Cinema has been $5, $6, and Paracinema is $7 with shipping. I mean, that's, you know, you're getting so many pages of great content, very few ads, and, you know, a beautifully laid out, you know, magazine, especially with Paracinema. But with Shock Cinema, my God, the thing is, what, 80 pages or something? Barely any ads inside of it. Every quarter you're getting this thing. And what is it? Is it $6 now or is it still $5? I mean, it's ridiculously cheap.
It might still be $5. But then,
ridiculous.
And they're also on the cheaper paper. I think Fangoria's biggest problem is they insist on that thick, glossy paper, which this is something I've had trouble with when comic books did this too. God forbid you try and read one of those glossy pages with a light source above your head. All you get is glare. You can't read a damn thing. Old newsprint copies? No problem. I could read those anywhere.
I think it would make it easier on the reader. I don't think they're gonna abandon that format, because I think it comes down to something that's literally as retarded as, look, it's shiny.
You really think this is like NASCAR fan, big shiny objects going in circles kind of thing?
Exactly. That's jingling your keys in front of a baby. That's all it is.
Mike, since you're still running your own magazine, which you, in a great lapse of logic, decided to print another thing I wrote, and you're going to pay for that, I'm sure. Where do you see your magazine? Do you see Cashiers du Cinemart as a real competitor, or are you making just an alternative voice?
Oh, God, no. Yeah, no, it's no competition to anybody out there. It's just it's something that I feel compelled to do, and something that people still feel compelled to help me out with. I mean, it's definitely changed over the years, of course. I mean, we've gone through so many different formats, and this one, I'm trying something different. It'll be kind of more of a book, kind of more I remember what Head Press years ago used to do, kind of theirs were really much more of a book format. They called themselves a magazine, but they were, you know, nice soft cover books. And that's what this one I'm thinking is going to kind of look like and be like. And it'll be kind of more of, you know, going back to my college days, reading the old film journals. And it'll be kind of a little bit more like that, like taking a bunch of essays and putting them inside of something. This one is not going to have a magazine look to it, in that we're not going to have the, you know, photos with the text going around it and all that kind of stuff that I usually like and that I used to like to do. But just with the way that things are now, I mean, the last issue kind of killed me just doing the layout stuff. And yeah, so it's definitely not any kind of competition to anybody. But then I don't know, you know, what kind of there's got to be competition going on between some of the magazines that we've talked about, as far as, you know, the Rue Morgue and the Horror Hound and those kind of things. But there are so many outliers now that still just kind of, you know, they're not eating anybody's lunch, but they're just, they're still going to sit at the counter.
What do you guys think about, like, Mike just brought up the whole essays. Something like Video Scope magazine that spends most of their magazine just reviewing current DVDs, and then you look at something like Paracinema, and they have essays on trends in film and things like that. I think that's where the big difference is. I don't want to read about a bunch of DVDs that just came out. I don't need their reviews for that. I prefer the essay style, where you're looking back at a trend, or you're talking about something you see, like the dark times coming if the Eli Ross ever get a $100 million budget or something like that. Where do you fall into that?
Well, I wish more publishers thought the way that Mike did. Don't try to, like, trick people the gimmick. Like, don't say, look, we got Jennifer Lopez to be a little bit more naked on our cover than they did on theirs. I like magazines that just put forth the best content that they can and let the reader decide. I think far too few people do that. But in terms of including essays and stuff like that, I would love that. I think magazines are kind of hamstringing themselves by thinking of themselves as only a news outlet. I think essays and stuff like that would be welcome. I remember in Entertainment Weekly, when I guess I was just out of high school when I was reading this. This was like an 8-part series that came out every week. It was Kevin Bacon's diary during the production of Hollow Man. Now, is Hollow Man an idiotic movie that I wish I had never heard of? Yes, it absolutely is. But reading Kevin Bacon's production journal was riveting. I was like looking forward to it like a cliffhanger every week. It was awesome.
Obviously, I enjoy, you know, the essay stuff. But I will say, too, you know, looking at Shock Cinema, I mean, that's all reviews. And they kick ass. But I think the thing there is that hardly anything that they're reviewing is, you know, new out on DVD this week kind of stuff. It is, you know, here's this incredibly rare film that somebody has uncovered and is now for sale, and let's take a look at this thing. And I just love that. I love the rarity of the pieces that they're reviewing, and I love the attitude of the reviewers.
Well, speaking of attitude, and Mike, I know you've encountered this. Charlie, I assume you have, and I know I have through friends of mine. The whole, we don't want to pay, but please write for us. And I don't mean like the way, Mike, you do it. I do it that with you because you're my friend and you're stupid enough to publish my stuff. I mean the whole thing that Fangoria did a few years ago, where they said, hey, do you guys want to see your reviews in print? Send it to us on the Fangoria website. And if we like it, we'll put it in the magazine. They just got 100 new interns right there that they didn't have to pay. And they got pages to fill for absolutely no turnout for on their end. That to me is both brilliant and sleazy at the same time.
It's very brilliant and sleazy. It's like the railroad tycoons that used to pay Chinese immigrants 10 cents a day just by virtue of the fact that there were tons of Chinese people available. I have made a total of $42 in my life as far as print work is concerned. Most of what I've done has been for free. And I think there's always going to be people like me dumb enough to fall for that.
That clearly amuses Mike.
Yeah, I'm counting on it.
No, I know what you mean. I don't know of I don't know how somebody could make a living these days off of writing for magazines. I'm sure way back in the day when you got a piece in Playboy or something, you're a Norman Mailer or Gore Vidal or somebody, you could probably make a pretty good living doing that. I just read Jules Feiffer's biography, and he was doing cartoons, and it was such a big deal to make it from, the Village Voice, which wasn't paying him anything, into the New Yorker or into Playboy and all that, and that was, getting up into the big leagues. I just with all the magazines that we've talked about so far, I'm sure that most of them don't pay very much, if anything. And I know me, I would love to pay people if I could, if I did some sort of profit sharing when it came to putting out an issue. And if I said, okay, minus all the costs that it is to put out this issue, I will share the profits. Once I make back that initial investment, I would probably be sending out, 2 and 3 cent checks every 6 months to a few people, and that's about it.
Well, because one thing I'm specifically thinking of, I mean, if the Fangoria thing was sleazy, what Dark Side magazine did was downright illegal. They were caught in the early 2000s taking blog reviews and reviews of DVDs. They ch would change a word here, a word there, change the byline, and put it in the magazine so they didn't have to pay anybody. They literally stole all their print reviews from the internet and then printed them under someone else's name. And eventually one guy noticed, there's like 8 of my reviews up there, but this magazine's never paid me. That was downright criminal. And that the magazine collapsed for a few years. They're back now. I don't know if it's new management, if it's new upscale management or not. The last thing you want to do is fall into the trap that Dark Side fell into. And then Fangoria also had a thing a couple of years ago. A couple of friends of mine wrote for them. And I don't mean on like the, hey, we'll print your review thing. They wrote for them legitimately, and this was under the old management, so this might very well have changed. Their checks never cleared. And after about 40 phone calls, they could never get another check, so they just gave up. They're like, it's only $150. It's not worth all this trouble. Fangoria had a little bit of a history of not paying their writers. Should that kind of thing be exposed more, or do you think that's kind of an internal beef kind of thing, Mike?
Oh yeah, I definitely think it should be exposed more. I mean, especially the, stealing of people's writing. I mean, that was such a huge thing just a few years ago when it was, God, what, just like recipes that people were copying and putting out there. And I'm not even talking about, God, who was the
The Queen's Sperm
McCain's.
Lady?
Yeah, just all the controversy around that. But yeah, that should definitely be brought to light, and I would hope that, there would be this is kind of backwards thinking, but I would hope that, if somebody's not getting paid for writing their stuff, that the blogosphere and the Twitterverse would be abuzz with those kind of things, and folks would actually know about it. I mean, it seems that it's kind of strange that the real scoop on so many magazines is actually being blogged about, rather than written about.
I remember the one of the friends of mine that didn't get paid. He was when he they after he bitched about it online, they called him up and they're like, dude, this was all internal. You didn't have to go public with this. They were like offended, not that they can't send him the check for the review or for the review or the article he wrote. They were pissed he went public with it. That's why I'm saying I think this should be exposed.
I think it should definitely be exposed. One of the most interesting news stories, damn, I guess this is about like 14, 15 years ago. Let me ask you guys both this question. Do you know the name David Manning?
Rings a bell.
Yeah, it sounds familiar, but I'm not sure who it is.
David Manning is a fictitious movie critic created by Sony Pictures.
Oh, that's right. I
Like
thanked him.
explosive 4-star review kind of thing, right?
Yeah, I think someone was made suspicious because they gave 4 stars to The Animal with Rob Schneider.
Dude, talk about overreaching. Come on.
Yeah, at least try to fool somebody.
At least make it a realistic positive review.
That
Yeah,
that
I
was
think
just a
that
fantastic scandal. I was so happy about that.
I think that that stuff still goes on today. I have a friend of mine who was going to, and I don't think he's done this yet, but he was going to take all of the New York Times quotes, you know, on any ads that were inside of the New York Times, just so you could have like a, you know, central location kind of thing, and try to track down all of the review quotes that were on those ads. I don't think he's ever done that, but I'm pretty sure that you would start to uncover some very interesting things if you were to do that on a regular basis.
I'm convinced that it's still going on. I think the only difference is now you have actual people willing to say stupid things like that. Like Peter Travers will say.
Like Peter Travers, yeah.
I mean, if you take Peter Travers, just read the year-end issue of Rolling Stone every year. He'll call it like six movies the best movie of the year. Something's not right.
There's a blog out there. I'm trying to remember. Is it like Jeffrey Lyons? Oh, gosh, it's a good one. It kind of really traces this whole thing and does do that. It will look at all of the, you know, this is the best movie of the year, and really call out the reviewers when they start to, you know, kind of eat their own hype, as far as it were, you know, and just like, okay, yeah, you said that this was the best movie of the year 2 weeks ago, you know, what about this is the best movie of the year, which is it?
Well, that also leads into the whole Harry Knowles scandal of Ain't It Cool News. For those that don't know, what Harry Knowles would do is he's personal friends with John Carpenter. So he'd get like set visits to Ghosts of Mars, and he'd get, you know, a full expense paid trip to the set of Godzilla. And these movies, no matter how bad they were, they would get glowing reviews. Only the movies he got invited to the sets of. And then there were other movies where he said, hey, can I get a set visit? And they said no. No matter how good the movie was, negative review. He basically was saying, reviews for sale, reviews for sale. Come on, I'm selling. Who's buying?
Well, yeah, I was going to make a reference to The Emperor's New Clothes, but I don't want to picture Harry Knowles naked.
Oh, God.
Please don't.
Yeah, there used to be a great blog that was only around for just a little bit, but where they would kind of track, it was like Ain't It Harry News, and it would be like the news about Harry Knowles instead of the Ain't It Cool News stuff, and I loved it.
That sounds awesome.
Well, and then you've also got the other thing with all these magazines. Now, this more so, it's going to go back to the cover argument I had. Let's move into adult magazines for the end of the show here. Is it just me, or does every issue of Penthouse, Hustler, and Playboy basically look the same at this point? Because I remember when Hustler and Penthouse, at least, had eye-catching covers. They had all these great, great covers that were not just a pretty girl in a pretty pose. And they don't do that anymore. I don't understand why. With porn on the internet, the only reason to buy an issue of Hustler anymore, and I know how old man this makes me sound, is for the articles. That's why you buy You don't buy Hustler for the women, because you can find far more graphic stuff just Googling any word in Google Images with Safe Search off. So I think it's kind of dumb for them to not go with the eye-catching original cover designs anymore. And yes, I'm giving some crap to Hustler. I've worked for them, and I might be getting a regular gig with LFP. That shows that I'm not one of those sellouts. I'm willing to tell them when I think they're doing dumb.
Yeah, I can't really speak to it. I mean, unless it's a hardcore fetish magazine, I don't really look at the mainstream porn stuff.
Well, Mike, you've got high standards, I'll give you that. I think, like, adult magazines are in a whole separate category, because, like, if I'm going to go to a steakhouse and have the best porterhouse I've ever had, subpar bread on the table is not going to ruin the experience for me. I don't think people are going out and buying Penthouse or Hustler or anything for the cover.
Hustler pays really well. The Hustler article I wrote, I made well over $500 for that single article.
Are you serious?
Yes, Hustler, LFP pays very well. That's why I'm very much looking forward to, I'm in final negotiations to have a semi-regular gig in print in Hustler. I'm really looking forward to that, because that'll help a lot. My thing is, I just think the adult magazines are just meh at this point when it comes to the actual sex. For instance, I've got a subscription to Playboy. I don't even look at the girls in that anymore. That's what the internet is for. I look at that for the reporting. Is that sick of me? Have I entered Bizarro World, Mike?
I don't know, because the last few times I've bought Playboy magazines, they've been from like 72 and 75, and I was buying them for the articles.
But
right?
But so back then you had Hunter Thompson writing for him and Stephen Kitkin, yeah. Ray Bradbury and William Gibson. God, yeah, you buy those old 70s issues.
Yeah, they were great stuff. So, I mean, if there are still articles that are worth it, you know, that's great. But I don't know, as far as the whole, you know, the content of the sex stuff, I remember I really quit buying any kind of mainstream magazine when there were like the urination wars that were going on, where it was like trying to get more and more extreme. And I think it was Penthouse. No, it was Hustler started having pictorials of girls peeing. And I was just like, there's nothing sexy about this at all. I even in the fetish magazines, it's just like, yeah, I don't really need to see the water sports or the golden showers, so I'm not really interested in seeing this in a mainstream mag. I don't know if they've gone away from that. I don't know if they're still trying to push the boundaries when it comes to what's acceptable in a mainstream porn magazine, which I know is kind of counterintuitive to say, but they really they lost me with that kind of stuff.
Well, I would definitely be all for magazines staying completely away from that unless it was part of an R. Kelly review.
hey Charlie, 1998 called. They want their joke back. Then what do you guys think about the wide dearth of different kind of subject magazines? You know, you've got Woodworking Magazine and Working Mother Magazine and Black Entrepreneur Magazine and Painting with Feces Magazine and Hunting Magazine. How does a magazine devoted specifically to bow hunting find something to write about every single month?
Because Ted Nugent gets bored.
Fair enough. Mike?
I wish I knew. I have actually looked through some of these, especially the Painting with Feces magazine, and I was just amazed that they could come up with content. But it was really, for me anyway, what I was looking at was more the ads and just seeing how these magazines can be a viable thing. And I don't know, are they still doing that? And the thing that I wanted to kind of get to before we sign off tonight is just the availability of magazines, I think, has just changed so much over the last few years. I mean, it used to be something where I could go into, you know, Barnes & Noble or Borders or some of these and just see tons and tons of magazines and just be amazed at the wide selection of all of these magazines. And now with the closing of Borders, the closing of Tower Records, I mean, Tower Records was just this, you know, heaven on earth for people that were in the magazines and zines. You know, you can go into Barnes & Noble, but those racks are shrinking, man. You're not seeing very much. And at least in my neck of the woods, we don't have something cool like an Atomic Books or a Quimby's or something where you can go in and see not just the mainstream stuff, not just the crazy porn stuff that we've been talking a little bit, but see the zines and see that, you know, just the whole wide spectrum that's available out there. And now it's like, not only is it, you know, I don't have enough magazines to buy, or there aren't very many magazines out there to buy anymore, but I don't even have a place to buy them at.
I don't know. I mean, I think that humanity is a rich enough tapestry where you're going to find a magazine for any activity that somebody is going to buy. And if the publishers can afford to keep putting it out just for this small niche market, then I say more power to them. What that reminded me of was one of the very few interviews I've ever seen with Joel and Ethan Coen. It was on the Bare Bones first issue edition of The Big Lebowski on DVD. Ethan Coen was talking about how Floor Coverings Weekly did a story on The Big Lebowski, and that was his favorite interview ever. And it wasn't until later where he asked himself the question, Floor Coverings need a weekly publication?
Hey, because that can really tie a room together, man. And, you know, you don't want the carpet pissers to do that, going back to Mike's water sports thing. So we've come full circle. We've come full circle, jerk. How's that? Where can we find Mike White?
Well, you can find me every week over at the Projection Booth, projection-booth.com. And, yeah, we will have a new issue of Cashiers to Cinemark coming out, and that will be available via impossiblefunky.com.
Charlie McMullen?
You can find me on Geek Juice Radio, geekjuicemedia.com, and Facebook. I spell my name weird, but it's worth trying.
No, it's not. You can find me at 1201beyond.com. contact me at 1201beyond@gmail.com. My weekly column, Sanity is Razor Thin, also at geekjuicemedia.com. And my monthly column, The Shadows of Pop Culture, in Scene Magazine. See? I'm writing for an actual monthly magazine. So
awesome.
You guys got anything you want to plug before the end of the show?
Geek Juice Media, check it out within the next, by the time this airs, I'll say within the next 2 weeks, Alex Jowski should be putting up my new comic strip. It's called Check Out My Briefs.
Well, I'm very excited that we're going to have a special guest coming up on the projection booth, Mr. Josh Hadley himself, as we talk about Runner. As we talk about Blade Runner in our very special mind-twisting sci-fi week, where we've got one episode about the 13th floor and World on a Wire, and then we're talking Blade Runner in a very special, gosh, it's going to be like a mega episode once this thing gets kind of all pieced together. So we have yet to record our interview with Mr. William Sanderson, but that will be happening pretty soon, and we'll go in the episode.
And we got into some weird, deep, philosophical Blade Runner territory there, didn't we?
Yeah, but yet there was still stuff that I wanted to talk about and totally forgot to do. I wanted to do like this whole comparison of Chandler and Spillane and then Dick and then also Fancher and Peoples and how they took each of these kind of things and went with it with the Blade Runner script.
I'm going to say good night.
Get out.